Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Okay. Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. You're here with me today, Charlie, taking up the reins because we are going into the 17th century, which, as you know, is where I like to hang out. And because today's guest is going to give us a little bit of something boaty, there was only one man I could think of to join me, and that is the wonderful Mr. Chris Sams. How are you doing today, Chris?
I'm good, Charlie. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, no, I'm really, really happy to have you here to join me in this wonderful nerdy boat fest. Who have we got joining us today, Chris?
Okay, today we have John van der Kist, who's going to be with us and he has specialised in researching and writing biographies of British royals from the Stuarts through to the Hanover up to Victoria, as well as other nations such as Germany, Greece, Austro-Hungary and Russia, as well as other subjects. And he's here today to talk to us about his new book, James II and the First Modern Revolution.
Hello, John. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Charlie.
So there we go, we've got you in. So to get started, we're going to talk about James before he was king for a little while. So in his early years before the Restoration, James was quite a lad when it came to his military escapades and also the diplomatic intrigues during his exile. How did these experiences mould him into the king he would become?
Well, first of all, he was always very eager to learn, and he was quite amenable to discipline in his early years. Right from the time he was a small boy, he had a high regard for order and routine, which suited him very well for military life. He was also, you know, quite brave, quite resourceful, and he was perfect soldier material. Another interesting thing to bear in mind about him was that, you know, he was only a boy when this gilded existence around him came crashing down. He realised that something was very wrong. There were external forces threatening his father. And quite early on, he was moved out from Whitehall to Hampton Court, where he's going to be a little bit safer, and then eventually moved to York. So he was not exactly a fugitive, but he was, you know, being shunted around rather against his will. So he realised that life was certainly not cosy, even though he was born to the purple, and that, you know, a soldier's life would obviously help to keep him, make him very quick-witted, keep him one step ahead of the game, and ahead of the enemies that were obviously, you know, threatening his existence and that of his family. As regards the diplomatic intrigues, you know, he was obviously used to being on the run and spirited away from England in 1648 into Holland. So he realised that the landscape could shift, you know, pretty quickly under him.
Gosh, so I mean, in terms of his upbringing and his sort of fit for military command, he's made Lord High Admiral at the age of 5, I understand.
Right. Yes. Of course, purely an honorary host, but yes, it did give him a sense that, you know, he was destined for, you know, great responsibilities in the country, you know, in the years to come.
Gosh, and he learns
school from it. Or, well, yes, at the age of 5.
it's a crazy thing to think of now, yeah. But of course, yes, the role was purely titular at that point. But after, when he's in exile with his brother, so Charles is, you know, he's hoping that he might be able to get his crown back. But James ends up being a little bit of a soldier of fortune, doesn't he? He fights under General Turenne for the French, and then he has to fight with the Spanish when the English ally was Spain, and it's all very confusing.
Well, it was indeed, and I suppose this prepared him very well for you know, whatever happens, he's got to be ready to meet it. And he was well aware you know, during the Protectorate in England that if the throne was not restored to his family and his brother, then he would probably have to end up becoming a professional soldier, a soldier of fortune, sort of more or less a gun for hire with any European head of state who would have him.
Now, I studied Charles quite a lot, John, so I know that there's sort of speculation that Charles was quite envious of James's military prowess. And it's this great story about how, having fought with Turenne and having fought with the French, he came up against the French when he was fighting for the Spanish. And the commander actually let James and his men go because they'd fought with him and they knew him and they weren't going to run him through.
That's right, yes. James is much more the military-minded type. I think maybe there's a case of Charles being Charles is naturally rather more easygoing as a personality. And I think he felt that as long as things go reasonably our way, I stand a jolly good chance of being restored to my father's throne, which he was. So he was a figurehead who would just sit back and let everybody do the work around him, in a sense. And James was the younger one who wasn't going to be king straight away. So obviously the responsibility of becoming a soldier fell upon him.
He also got offered the position of admiral in the Spanish Navy as well, just before the Restoration.
Wow.
That's right, yes. Since it's gone differently, then he may very well have ended up in the employ of the Spaniards, yes.
Because that was just before the Restoration and he turned it down, which bounced quite nicely. But sort of following the Restoration, James causes a bit of a scandal by marrying Anne Hyde, who was a commoner. And despite being devoted to her and her children, he kept several mistresses, including a Churchill, and was referred to as Pete as the most unguarded ogler of his time. We've all met that guy. But how does this stack up against his religious stance and piousness?
Well, yeah, he was a bit of a split personality, I suppose you could say. There's possibly a bit of a sense of a medieval, or sort of before his time, Rasputin character about him. You know, this old joke about if you're going to go to confession and confess your sins, well, first you've got to sin. It seemed that he just did not equate, being a good Christian, being a good Catholic. Being a good Christian with being totally moral above reproach, and also a lot of people at the Stuart court, a lot of men were really pretty unfaithful to their wives. And I suppose in that day and age, it was just accepted that there's one rule for men, one rule for women. But they did regard James as being possibly one of the least moral of the lot, judged by the number of different mistresses he had, although he also had a wife at the same time.
It's possibly a bit ungenerous, but there was a remark about how his mistresses were, I'm going to be diplomatic and say, far from beautiful as well. And there was a comment about the king was punishing himself by seeing them.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, you do get the impression that, he just wasn't that fussy, either that or else. How do you put it politely? But he was just up for it all the time. That's probably the politest way of putting it.
Those brothers, they did have that much in common. Yes. Oh, but Anne Hyde, there was a big controversy because they were married in secret, weren't they?
Yes, the oldest child, the son, was the one who died quite young, but they had to make sure that the marriage was all done and dusted first.
He did a few things in secret, did our James. Biggest of which, we can almost set aside the marriage in secret of the Duke of York. He converted to Catholicism in secret. Now, this is a time where anti-Catholic suspicion and exclusion were just par for the course. So it must have been a part of him that thought what he was doing was a bad idea or ill-advised in some way. Did he have any sense that he was risking his his entire future by converting?
I don't really think so. I think he just felt that he was invincible. He was the king's brother. He was almost certainly going to become king one day. And you know, he felt that, you know, to a certain extent, he could make the rules himself and, you know, just do what he jolly well wanted to. he was very much pro-Catholic inclined, you know, from adolescence. He'd been very impressed as a boy by the devotion with which the Catholics worshipped God. And he came to realise that they were not the reprobates that the English Protestants were trying to portray them as. Mm. And you know, somehow he did slightly check against the Protestants at this point. And I think he felt that they just weren't really taking their religion that seriously. And, you know, being a very earnest-minded man himself, you know, he really thought that the Catholics were the regal deal, I suppose.
He does seem to have been a very serious and stubborn individual. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that's just sort of what people have painted him as?
I think that's very fair to say. We get the impression that he was rather humourless, and that he just totally lacked his brother Charles' lightness of touch. I mean, Charles for nothing is not for nothing known as the Merry Monarch. And he was. He was very laid back, much more relaxed, had much more of a sense of humour, and didn't take life quite so seriously. James was the exact opposite in that.
Gosh, they came from the same place. It's crazy.
Well, quite often in your family, you get one person who's a joker, and the other one who takes it all so seriously, and just the same kind of thing, really. Mm.
I know we've mentioned it already, but James also still held the position of High Admiral, which puts him in charge of the Royal Navy, notably during the Second and Third Anglo-Dutch Wars. And we remember the Medway, well, especially I remember the Medway being a Gillingham local. But we also have the Four Days Battle and the Battle of Texel, and they're all going against England. Would it be fair to say that his tenure as CNC of the Navy was a bit of a disaster?
Well, I think that's quite fair to say. He couldn't be blamed, obviously, for the fact that, well, in simple terms, you know, the Dutch were really rather superior to the British. But you know, he had been appointed Lord High Admiral to come and help to reorganise the Navy, which had been very much neglected over the last few decades. And so you know, he had quite a huge job ahead of him. But he was also a sort of unofficial head of the war party in Britain. And you know, when the Dutch were threatening British trade, then you know, he was very much one of come on, let's go for the fray, let's go and take the Dutch on. And the Navy weren't really ready for it, and just paid the price. And in fact, the Medway raid in 1667, it was not only a great success for the Dutch, but it was also one of the worst defeats that the British Royal Navy ever suffered. And you know, he was very lucky, you know, not to be blamed for it. I think everybody just took the common sense view that, it was just misfortune anyway, rather than down to any fault of his own. But the person who really took the blame for it all was his father-in-law, the Earl of Clarendon, who was a Lord Chancellor. And mainly as a result of our defeat in the war, he was told to surrender his great seal of office. And there was just nothing left for him in England. And he fled to France, where he spent the rest of his life in exile. So James is jolly lucky that somebody else was around to take the blame.
Absolutely. I mean, that is mainly down to the fact that they ran out of ammunition up in the castle on the line. So there was kind of that, it can't be the Navy's fault because they just didn't have, no one to supply them with enough ammo. But James then went on to help start the fortification process and the rebuilding of defences, which continued for another 200 years in Medway anyway.
Saved his reputation, really, yes.
James had actually ordered that the Royal Charles be moved in, I think it was March. He'd told Peter Pett, who's head shipwright at Chatham, he told him to move the Royal Charles. So when it got unceremoniously towed away, he was apparently absolutely furious because his orders had been disobeyed. So.
Yeah.
But at that time, I mean, people didn't know. The people in London who are actually keeping an eye on what's happening at Chatham, they don't know what the Dutch are going to do. They don't know that they're not going to turn round and try coming up the Thames into London. This could have been the attack. This could have been the full-scale invasion at that moment. But, yeah.
They did occupy Sheerness.
They did.
And then gave it back.
And apparently, just before Sol Bay, the Dutch had tried to go after Sheerness again. They tried to get back in, to get back into Chatham Docks again, and got blocked off at Sheerness. All good fun. All good fun stuff.
Quite a learning curve, really, wasn't it? But I think once the defeats had come from the Dutch, then they realised that realised that the British Navy had to up their game after that.
They really did. And Texel was another sort of big disaster of the Third Anglo-Dutch War. And this is in the 1670s, isn't it, John?
That's right, yes. But after that, the Dutch sort of rather ran out of stomach for the fight, and I think they realised that most of the actions in that final war were more or less indecisive. The Dutch did slightly have the upper hand, but they sort of rather lost heart for it. Britain obviously was in no financial state to pursue the war, so it was just a sort of a fairly easy peace, but an uneasy one between the two countries.
Do you think this is one of the reasons why people don't generally know more about the Anglo-Dutch Wars, is the fact that it wasn't conclusive? And frankly, we didn't win. We didn't get that sort of great, glorious victory. Do you think that's one of the reasons why people don't really talk about the Anglo-Dutch Wars at all?
I think it probably is, yes. I suppose you could say it's a really not a very exciting war because, we didn't win it, but then it was only a sort of, fairly thin victory for the Dutch, and there were no tremendous consequences from it because England was sort of rather caught between France and Holland at the time. It was war with the Dutch largely because it wanted to protect its trade, and the Dutch were the supreme traders of the 17th century. Well, Britain wanted a bit of action over that, but on the other hand, Britain did have a vested interest in trying to limit the power of France, which was regarded very much as the enemy at that time. Of course, well, there were exceptions because James was actually quite pro-French because that was a great Catholic nation, but there was a lot of distrust of France, throughout the British people and throughout the Protestant population, and to a certain extent, Charles himself. So it was a very delicate balancing game.
It really was. We've mentioned him. I'm gonna drag us back there because John, you'll probably have picked up. This is my favourite person in history. So Charles II was exceptionally popular as a monarch. Really, he got away with a lot. But even before he died, there were moves to stop James from succeeding him in favour of Monmouth. Now we're gonna have to talk a bit about Monmouth. Who was the Duke of Monmouth, and was the anti-James feeling really that strong that they'd put this person in position before him?
This is one of the great mysteries, I suppose, how they actually managed to flop to the standard of Monmouth, or quite a lot of them, because he was the illegitimate son of Charles II, poor old Charles, and Catherine of Braganza were not able to produce any legitimate heirs or heiresses. So Monmouth was the one, was the son of Charles by his mistress, Lucy Walters. And to being quite popular, they thought, well, Monmouth is going to be very like father, like son, and he could probably be moulded quite well as a king, as a figurehead. James was not at all popular. He was regarded as being very dour, very earnest, even though, of course, you've got mistresses aplenty. But the picture of him was he was a bit of a gloomy, moralising convert, really, pretty much out to spoil everybody's fun. Also, he was a very much an advocate of pro-French and pro-Catholic policies, and this did not go down well at all in Britain as a whole. So yeah, maybe Monmouth wasn't ideal because of his illegitimacy, but a lot of people saw him, you know, as a rather better option.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing running in the background all the time was that Charles II did regard the royal succession as sacrosanct, and he realised his brother is his heir and he shouldn't really do anything to supplant him. And some of the ministers around him thought that he might possibly be amenable to pressure to remove James from the succession and get Monmouth instead. But Charles did have very much this sense of fair play regarding the royal succession and said, no, James was the one, for all his faults. Okay, he may be terribly pro-Catholic, maybe rather pro-French, but that can be kept in check if the ministers do rein him in enough.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles ends up dissolving Parliament to stop them passing a bill.
That's right, yes.
He does. They wouldn't stop. They wouldn't stop calling for James to go. But I think the logic was is if they can pick their monarch now, what's to stop them doing it again and again?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, yes. Well, look at the Wars of the Roses, for instance. When you had two or three suitable candidates to pick, between the Yorkists and the Lancastrians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also there was a feeling that the Wars of the Roses that plunged the royal succession into chaos quite a lot. Well, sure enough, things had moved on in the last 200 years or so, but they did not want any sort of crisis like that. So, best rally around the most obvious candidate, who was James.
Mm, absolutely. Well, whatever you say about Monmouth, he may or may not have been Charles's legitimate son, because there were rumours that he may have married Lucy Walter in private, and he was urged to say that he had, definitely. But James was undeniably the second son of Charles I. There was no argument there.
So done deal, really.
Done deal. Oh, if only. That would have made it much, much easier. But I think maybe part of the fact is that Monmouth was young and handsome and Protestant.
Yes. And hopefully like his father and a good chap, which James wasn't. Well, I suppose James was sort of very upright and earnest, but that didn't count for much. I mean, just sort of take a more modern analogy, Albert Prince Consort was a very upright moral type, but quite frankly a bit of a bore and wasn't really that popular. Edward VII was a libidinous one with the mistresses, but good old Teddy.
Mm.
You can't have everything, can you?
No.
Who do you choose? The good bloke or the really moral one?
But Monmouth does sort of make a play for the crown by invading, coming in from Holland and invading the West Country, whilst Argyle comes into Scotland, and they lead two very unpopular rebellions. They didn't attract that many soldiers and it failed horrendously. James then dispatches apparently one of my ancestors, Judge Jeffreys, to go and deal with it, and it's put down very, very brutally. How did the people react to this?
Well, I think up to a certain point they were prepared to accept it because they couldn't do anything about it. But the thing that really perturbed them more than anything else was that James was probably becoming more inflexible. He saw that there were revolts against him, not one, but two, which could possibly have gone the other way if they had been better prepared and if more people had flocked to the standards of Argyle or Monmouth. And he realised he had to be prepared for this. So what did he do? He went and enlarged his standing army.
Mm. Now,
people feared trouble from the soldiers in the army because they tended to be billeted on the towns and they would be greedy, they would cause trouble and sort of no end of chaos. Also, it was contrary to English tradition to keep a large professional army in peacetime because they felt there was really no need for it. A large army, that meant they've got to prepare themselves for trouble ahead, which might possibly not come. And it just totally smacked of authoritarianism. So So I suppose that you know that really was the main effect of the two rebellions. You know, James just getting prepared in case you know, anything worse should happen later. Mm. And as we know, of course, well, worse for him from his point of view, it did come when William of Orange started stirring overseas.
Yeah, you've made a really wonderful point in the book, which I picked up on, which is that perhaps Parliament would have been more prepared to overlook James's Catholicism if it hadn't been for fear of what you've described very neatly as the political side of Catholicism, which is absolutism. And it seems that these two fears go hand in hand. The fear of having a Catholic monarch is hand in hand with having an absolute monarch who would rule absolutely. He's got an army, he doesn't have a parliament, what he says goes, and that seems to be what they're worried about. Do you think that's what James was trying to do?
I think so, yes. I think there was this growing feeling that Catholicism equaled absolutism, you know, a preferment for Catholics in offices of state, and they were going to take over the country. And you know, this is contrary to the kind of English philosophy of live and let live, you know, equal rights for Catholics, equal rights for Protestants, you know, don't go preferring one at the expense of the other.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously, James being you know, more and more, becoming more obstinate and inflexible by the year. And, yeah. You know, he's just contrary to this. And this is why his support gradually ebbed away.
And he's really chipping away at what Parliament managed to get through in Charles's time. So every time Charles tried to pass indulgence to make it just to make it easier for people to be Catholic if they wanted to be, every time he did it, the pushback was so extreme that they passed in 1673, 1674, the Test Act, which meant that no Catholic could hold high office. And James at that point had to resign from the Navy, but he hasn't managed to unpick it, but he's very much going against it this time, isn't he?
Yes, well, yeah, he saw that he was on rather slippery ground, and I think part of his plan was just to sit back and you know see how things panned out. But then later on we had the Exclusion Acts coming on, and you know, he realised that you know things might not go his way, so. Partly a matter of luck that he did in the end.
So things start going from bad to worse for James at this time with something rather wonderful. Yeah. So he's building this army. He's got a lot of Catholics in his Privy Council and in high office. So there's clearly preferment for Catholics. And then something lovely happens. He has a son. And this proves a major spark for the revolution, which is going to come. So tell us a little bit about the birth of James's son, why it was controversial, and why this made revolution inevitable.
Well, James and Mary had not had much luck in trying to raise a family so far, because there had been a lot of miscarriages, stillbirths, you know, princes and princesses, and you know, they were both quite desperate about it. And suddenly it seemed an absolute miracle in 1687 when they realised that Queen Mary was with child. And of course, obviously a lot could go wrong, and a lot had gone wrong with the previous pregnancies, but a living son was born in June 1688. And it was this took a lot of people by surprise, and some people immediately thought, could be dirty. Has he been smuggled in a warming pan? Was there a stillborn infant, and they managed to ferry somebody in while nobody was looking? There was quite a lot of suspicion about this, that this might have happened, and it coincided with the trial of the seven bishops, who contrary to the king's expectations were exonerated from all blame. Bishops were pronounced totally innocent at the trial, and that coinciding with the fact that there was this rather suspicious Prince of Wales, they thought this child had been foisted on them, and also they had been prepared to regard James and his Catholic policies as being a bit of a temporary phenomenon. Those will soon pass away because next in succession to the throne was his daughter Mary and then her sister Anne, because Mary was childless. So they thought, okay, right, we'll go bide our time. James is getting quite elderly. He's in his mid-50s. He's probably not going to live much longer. But the birth of the son completely changed that. They knew, right, the son would follow him on the throne. This is where we start taking action. And that was when the negotiations with William of Orange started. Would he come over and invade? He was married to Mary, so he was a sort of heir in waiting as well. And that is when James really started unravelling quite fast.
I mean, far be it from me to perpetuate 300-year-old rumours, but I've looked into, this is something I find very interesting, and I've looked into the various pregnancies of Mary of Modena, James's wife, and she falls pregnant pretty much the minute she comes over and they're married. So there's a lot of she buries a lot of children. There are a lot of miscarriages. It's all incredibly painful, especially when you think of how young she was. So when she had her first child, she was 17 years old. And she buried that first child when she was 18. So this is all awful stuff. And it goes on through 1674, 1675. And she's pretty much conceiving every year. Sometimes she is having babies. They aren't making it to adulthood. Some of them are stillborn. There are miscarriages, and like I say, it's all incredibly painful to read. But the birth of the prince, the little prince that we're talking about, he comes after a break of 3 years and 3 months without any sign of any pregnancy. So you can kind of see why people would think, hang on, this all feels very convenient. And in your book, you said that Mary was very reluctant to let anybody inspect her, anyone to see her belly. And even Princess Anne may have had her suspicions as well.
Yes, so it was all, so I suppose, rather unfairly stacked up against her. You know, maybe she wasn't playing her cards right, but you quite understand, you know, why she's being so cautious about it. That's yes, it just looks rather too good to be true from her point of view, and you know, it's hardly surprising that people smelt a rat, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I was, like I say, I was reading your book, and I was thinking, I'm trying to weigh up all the evidence that's presented, and you mentioned that, of course, as would be standard for a Queen of England, she doesn't get to give birth quietly on her own. There were 30 witnesses, I understand. Do we know who they were?
Members of the household and some of the senior officers of state.
Yeah.
Just to give some sort of legitimacy to the whole performance.
What do you think, Chris? Does this sound dodgy to you?
Yeah, they do sound like the people that could easily be influenced to say oh yeah we saw it,
absolutely, definitely. But then there were rumors that maybe she had given birth, but that child had sadly died, and they'd smuggled in a replacement.
Yeah, so they've got one in waiting just in case.
Gosh.
But James does ultimately fall in the Glorious Revolution, but that's not it for him. And he then goes on to Ireland to try and raise an army to retake the two kingdoms, which obviously goes wrong with the Battle of the Boyne. But was this just a death throw or a last roll of the dice? Was there any real chance of him regaining the throne then?
Not really, because James is very reluctant, and you know, he's in two minds. Even while he's fleeing England at the end of 1688, so he was very much, well, one moment he thought, well, why don't I just stay and fight this out? And then the next moment he thought, well, no, I've lost. I might just as well carry on to France. And then, you know, this was about invading Ireland. You know, his heart wasn't in it. You know, he was getting quite elderly at this time. And there are also theories that possibly he might have had some kind of, you know, whatever the 17th century equivalent of dementia was.
Right.
So, oh, wow. Yes, he was in his mid to late 50s at this time, which is really quite old for the late 17th century. And, you know, he just didn't want to be bothered. He'd far rather spend the rest of his time in exile in France. But it's really Louis XIV who got behind him, who persuaded him, look, you owe this to your wife and your son. Are you going to throw their inheritance away? Invade Ireland. You've got a reasonable chance of success. You will have French troops to help you. Mm. And so, you could very well put the disaster of 1688 right again. So they had a go, but the Irish army was very large, but mostly untrained, very poorly armed. William's forces were smaller, but they were far superior. And it was a really kind of David and Goliath situation. Battle of the Boyne came, and James actually stood watching it from a hill because he didn't get involved. And once he saw that it wasn't going his way, then that was really when he gave up the fight. So I don't think anybody really thought it had much chance of success at all.
I mean, we've skipped over a little bit here. I mean, in talking about what has become called the Glorious Revolution, was it really that simple? Did England just say, hey, William, Mary, get over here, we don't want this king anymore, and it just switched? Was no, they call it bloodless, but that can't be right.
It wasn't completely bloodless. That is a little bit of an exaggeration, a bit of a simplification, because there was quite a lot of violence going on between the waters of both sides, and there were a couple of small battles. There was one in Somerset, there was one near Reading, but so we've only got very sketchy accounts of those. They were nothing like on the scale of the Battle of Sedgemoor, for instance. And as far as we know, there were a few casualties, but how many were there were, we don't know. May possibly been as few of a dozen as a dozen. Might possibly have been about 50 or 60 people killed. By and large, the English welcomed William of Orange and said, yes, come over, come and save us from this extreme Catholic. And another thing that's sort of slightly complicated and simplified at the same time was, they were keeping it in the family because William was, after all, James's son-in-law, Mary being his wife. And so it was really a case of, let's hand it on to James's next heir, but obviously it's got to be legitimised. Mm. So William and his forces invaded, and James gave up with hardly a fight at all.
Gosh. I think people forget as well that William was also, he was also a Stuart. He was James's nephew, well, yes, as well as his son-in-law.
Yes, it was almost incestuous. Yes, in a way.
And everyone's got the same name, because William's mother was also called Mary, and she was James's sister.
It makes it so much easier.
And she married William. So his parents were William and Mary, and he was William and his wife was Mary. It's just, they just do it to be awkward, don't they?
Good say they do, yes. William showed that he wasn't going to be a tyrant. He was going to be fairly flexible, and he knew that he did rather owe his position as king to making sure he did what Parliament told him to. So there were a lot of safeguards on royal power at that time, and to that extent, it was fairly amicable.
So it's kind of a complete reversal to James's rule, and that, I mean, they also get rid of a lot of the ministers that have been pro James as well. But yeah, so William does a complete U-turn.
Indeed, yes.
Gosh, and that's not even going into the number of people who must have literally sold James out. His army and his commanders must have turned coat very quickly when they realised he was not going to fight.
They realized that, you know, he'd obviously got no stomach for the fight, so they made their peace with the new regime. The Duke of Marlborough, for instance, was one of them. You know, he did, I think, have a bit of a soft spot in his heart for James, but he realized that obviously it made more sense to throw his lot in with the winning side.
So this would be John Churchill, James's former protege, selling out his patron, and everyone wonders why I think John Churchill wasn't a very nice person.
He wasn't the only one. There were a lot of them, because they knew, obviously, you've got to sail with the tide. You don't sail against it.
Oh, I think that's very fair. I think you're being very kind to him there, John.
it was quite a division on family lines, wasn't it? Because Princess Anne, who later became queen, she was very much torn between her sister and her father. But eventually she realised, well, her father, unfortunately, is one who's sowing the seeds of dissension. So somewhat reluctantly, she went and threw in her lot with sister and brother-in-law. I mean, what else could the poor woman do?
I think, yeah, exactly. I think you're put in that position, what are you going to do? I'm going to let Chris ask the next question, because I know he's a fan of all things Polish. Go on, Chris.
That's going to get me in trouble. When James is in exile, he very interestingly gets offered a new job opportunity in the form of King of Poland. But he turns it down because he worries that it's going to affect the legitimacy of his son's attempts to regain the English crown. But would he have made a decent King of Poland?
Well, he probably wouldn't have really been much more than a figurehead, really. I think particularly after his difficult experiences in England, Poland was a much smaller kingdom and didn't really carry a lot of weight on the European stage. So I think he would probably have been largely in the hands of his ministers. You know, quite how obstinate he would have been in trying to impose his arbitrary will on everybody, that we don't know. But I think there again, we've got this sort of ageing thing. He would have been nearly 60 by then, and he would have, I think it would have been just very much of a non-entity. And as you know, he rejected the idea entirely because he did not want to spoil what little chances his son James might possibly have had of succeeding in William III. So he was a bit of a non sequitur, really. Didn't really get anywhere very far.
Gosh. I mean, talking about James's heirs would be that's a whole other episode. But what happens to James? What becomes of him?
James went to live at Saint-Germain-en-Laye near Paris, very much as a sort of a guest of Louis XIV. He just passed his time mostly in prayer, devotions, reading the Bible, leading this sort of rather dull life. Well, sort of dull, well, an adventure, I suppose. He probably had his share of adventure after all. And Queen Mary was quite content with it. She obviously didn't have much opportunity to do anything else. But by this time, he was becoming quite ill. Had several illnesses, and he died at the age of 67. Died in 1701, and that was just the end of it. But I think he was probably fairly happy to give up his earthly fights, and he accepted death quite passively. And so
it feels like quite a sad ending, almost, doesn't it? Yeah, sort of quiet.
Well, obviously, as we know, other post monarchs have ended up far worse than he ever did. Look at poor Louis XIV. About 100 years later, look at Tsar Nicholas II. By comparison with them, he got off quite lightly.
Or even comparing him to his father. But I mean, which I'm going to have to kind of do anyway, because he seems to have repeated all the same errors that his father made of, disregarding Parliament, imposing the divine right of kings as such. Would it be fair to summarise that he did, sort of surmise that he did just repeat his father's mistakes and was therefore doomed to failure?
I think he largely did because he had his father's obstinacy. He was a king, believed in the divine right of kings, and just felt that he was untouchable. Whereas Charles II, by complete contrast, he was just an easygoing one who let the world shape itself around him. And he wasn't prepared to go against Parliament. He wasn't going to go on his travels again. He just thought anything for an easy life. Mm. And he was one who actually died a king. So
he saw it coming with James, didn't he? Charles saw he saw this coming with James.
Yes. Well, yes, he did. And I suppose he just felt it was his duty to do what was right, even if it did cost him his crown, which, of course, it did fairly soon.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, your lovely book, John, James II and the First Modern Revolution, is published by Pen and Sword. So we're going to try and get that available on the History Hack bookstore so that people can pick it up. Thank you so much for joining us, John van der Kist. We look forward to seeing what you write next.
Absolutely.
I've got more books on the way.
Oh, yes. Are you going to go? Because I know you write about popular music as well as fantastic historical things.
I do, yes. Those are my main parallels. On the historical side, I've got William IV coming up next.
Uh-huh.
And ooh, I've got Queen Victoria's daughter-in-law coming up after that. I'm just finishing that off. But I also do books on rock music, so mostly concentrated on the 70s. I've got one coming out, I think, probably we're April, aren't we? Yeah, later on this month. I've got one coming out on Free and Bad Company.
Oh, Paul Rodgers, love him.
Oh, that's right, yes, one of the great British vocalists. I've just had one published on Mott Hoople and Ian Hunter. and I'm currently writing one on Manfred Mann's Earth Band.
That sounds absolutely fantastic.
Very eclectic selection.
We love eclectic people here at History Hack. Chris, thank you for being my wingman today. It's been brilliant fun.
Anytime.
And thank you, John.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlie. It's been lovely. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great